Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Vicki Mazzone. On today's show, we present the final installment of Broadband, the show within a show hosted by Denise Kowalczyk. ML Laurie discusses why we hide our concerns and fears. On The She-Ra Solution, Kristen Thiel reveals how the spacesuit was created by women who sewed bras for a living. First up is an interview that I did recently with Dr. Sherry Campbell, discussing her recently published book entitled, But It's Your Family. Here's that interview. My guest today on The Politics of Living is a clinical psychologist, counselor, and author, Dr. Sherry Campbell. Dr. Campbell is also a writer for both Huffington Post and Entrepreneur.com. Her latest book entitled, But It's Your Family, Cutting Ties with Toxic Family Members and Loving Yourself in the Aftermath, was released in April of this year through Morgan James Publishing. Welcome to The Politics of Living, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking about this book, and so I'm happy to share it with your audience.
Dr. Sherry, in the beginning of the book, there is a quote titled, Beneath the Surface. It's a longer quote, but the line that really leaped out for me was, a little girl who's had to learn that life is all hustle and no handouts. Where did this quote come from, and why was it chosen as the beginning of the book?
You know, I saw this quote, I think, on Instagram, and the minute that I read it, it almost explained my life in about six lines. When you grow up in toxic family dynamics, life is just an uphill, stressful climb, and you learn very quickly that things aren't going to come easy. Not that they come easy for kids and healthier families, but when you have a toxic family, life is especially hard because you're fighting the battle of the world while at the same time fighting the battle at home, that there shouldn't be a battle there. So the quote really resonated with me and how hard I've had to work in my life to become physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually healthy.
I am sure that this book will resonate with many, many people, whether it's a toxic family member or other toxic relationship. Do you think this kind of behavior is increasing, or does it just seem that way now that there's much more awareness these days? There's much more ways to identify these behaviors and to know the causes?
I think it's both. I do think it's increasing as I think the narcissism of our country increases, but mental health is more trendy. And so it's in everyday language now. So I also think, to your point, that it's also just kind of more, not advertised, but it's more talked about, you know, more easily. So
there's a level of awareness.
There's a level of awareness now, yes. And I still think our society is becoming more narcissistic. So I think it's going to increase, actually.
You see the whole country as a whole getting more narcissistic. What do you think's driving that?
I think our leadership right now is driving that. I think that our leadership has done some good things financially, but as far as people and how our leadership is pulling people apart and the way our leadership treats people is a very bad example of narcissism. And it's allowing others that are toxic to truly act out in ways where they feel justified to do it because the leadership is doing it. So whether it's a country, a corporation, or a family, if the leadership is sick, the trickle effect is it's going to be sick all the way through.
So you draw upon others' work in this book. You mention authors Shannon Thomas and Scott Peck specifically. You also present examples from your own counseling work, and you're also very candid about your own experiences within your own family. And I found that tone in the book to be very factual. Yeah. What was your turning point in your own realization with your family members?
It's like putting rocks of pain in a bag. And if you put enough of those rocks in that bag, at the end of the day, that bag is going to break. The bandwidth is going to reach its limit. My last interaction with my mother specifically wasn't the worst one we'd ever have, but it broke the bag. I realized that I was either going to continue to go back to that burning building or I was going to have to jump to save my life. I just knew that I could never go back, that every time I saw her, it was going to be painful and dramatic and unnecessary emotional pain. That was it for me. You know, it wasn't like it was our biggest fight on that day or our biggest disagreement or her biggest time of acting out, but I just reached my limit. I just knew that if these small things are now going to happen, there was just no way that I could ever be happy or safe in a relationship with her.
That makes sense.
And it's those small little things that are insidious that bleed away your self-worth. They just siphon it away. It's one little passive-aggressive dig after another. And at some point, you just lose your tolerance for it, which is a very healthy place to be. When you are done being treated bad, this is a step into a life of a lot more happiness.
You also talk in the book about avoiding the 8 ways to mess up your children. And I thought you might want to talk a little bit about some of those.
Well, you definitely do not want to be telling your child who to be. You know, you can't be needing them to be a cheerleader because that makes you look good. You need to let your kids, you know, explore themselves. You don't want to be their best friend. You don't want to be their therapist. You don't want to be someone who's never wrong to your kids, and you don't want to minimize their feelings. You want to be there to support them and love them the best way that you can. And the book also covers, you know, those 7 things that kids really need to hear. And one of those things is that I'm wrong. You know, if you want your kids to be able to be wrong, you have to show them that you can be wrong. And it's okay to be wrong.
And one of the things that you mention in the book you're very specific about is that toxic people are never wrong. They never will admit to being wrong. It's actually one of your healing moments, I think, that you mention in the book.
Once you know that they will never, like, for instance, my mother would rather never see me or my daughter again than simply own it and say she's sorry. The pride is so big that it supersedes her ability to be a parent. When you realize that that is the sickness that that person has, and they look at themselves as above reproach, it makes life a lot easier for you, not less painful, but easier, in that you will stop making the effort to try to convince them of where and how they hurt you and why, because they'll never validate you. That's more painful. To never be validated is really painful.
You have these healing moments throughout the book when you're presenting a lot of these hard truths, and they're statements that are sort of naked in their truth, these healing moments, but they're comforting. For instance, here's an example. Toxic people don't love, they manipulate. That's a statement of fact. Did you have a list of these going in, or did you write them as you went along when you were writing the book?
I wrote them as I went along. You know, I blog to almost 107,000 people now every day, and I use just those moments. But writing is very cathartic, and there are things that will manifest in writing that really wouldn't manifest for me in any other way. Those moments were really special for me because not only were they insightful for me, but those, I think the brain, especially in trauma, likes little quick tips. And I wanted the readers to have the heavy load of the truth, but to also supply that reader with a quick tip that they could revisit. Just reading those healing moments can really be helpful when you're in a place of pain. I just wanted them to have quick therapy, quick moments of, okay, this is reality. I'm not crazy. And this is a simple way I can handle it or think about it that makes me feel loved right now in this moment without having to read an entire chapter.
It reinforces the chapter, but it also gives a little relief from the hard truth.
Yeah, because this is a heavy topic. Cutting ties with family is no joke. And at the end of the day, if you can save some remnant of yourself from having to do that, and you can find some functional way for you to coexist in certain areas of your toxic family members that they can be enjoyable in, then I suggest that you do it.
One of the things you talk about in the book is you speak of the 5 myths of forgiveness. And I wanted to quote 2 items directly from that book. The first item is, quote, there are things done to us that are inhumane and unforgivable. Acknowledging this is not wrong. It is simply affirming reality. The second quote is, forgiveness. If it is real, it must be voluntary, and it must take into account and acknowledge the true depravity of what it is being offered for. It cannot be demanded. It can only be granted. And that's up to the person. The perpetrator deserves only justice for the damage they have caused.
Many of the myths of forgiveness that are out there punish the victim. If you don't forgive, now it's on you, and you're going to carry an anger and a bitterness all throughout your life. And the facts are is that toxic family, they do unforgivable things to us repetitively, and they're not sorry. If someone is not sorry, then I will not forgive them. Nor does that mean in any way that I'm angry or bitter or they're stealing my energy. What I did do for myself, however, is that I accept them for exactly who they are. I might want them to change, but I don't need them to change anymore. My healing could not begin if I was forgiving to look good to God or to look good to my friends or to look good to society as a whole, to look like I wasn't a bitter person. That has nothing to do with what I feel on the inside. The more that I wanted my family members to be different, the more angry I became. So a lack of acceptance of who they really are in their toxicity is what kept me bitter. It had nothing to do with forgiveness. And I don't forgive them. What's been done to me should not have been done to me. I don't condone it. I don't okay it. I accept it, and I'm not angry about it anymore on an everyday level. I have moments, right? This is my family. So there are moments of anger that I have, but it doesn't stop me from living. I just have moments. And then I remind myself of exactly who they are and of exactly why I've made the decisions I've made, and that I'm in a much safer and happier place because of it. We get caught up in forgiveness and we're punished for it, and that's abusing the victim again.
Because it adds on to the burden of these repeated traumas. Oh, and by the way, it's also your responsibility to do this forgiving piece.
Absolutely. There are things that people do that just are not forgivable under any circumstances. You don't hurt your children purposefully, period. Actions have consequences. If you don't want consequences, treat people right. Toxic people don't want to do that, and they don't want consequences.
What is the point at which people realize the illusion they had of this person changing is just that, an illusion? What do you think that awareness point is for people?
I think it comes kind of like from what I said before. You get to a point where your bandwidth and your patience and your over-forgiving and your justifying, denying, you know, their behavior, it just comes to a place where it stops. Toxic people are very ignorant to think that eventually we won't tire of the way they treat us. But when we're their children, we have to let them treat us that way just because we need food, home, and shelter. And it's very scary for children to think that their parents aren't stable. So we make up a story about them that helps us to cope. So we make up the story that we must be bad or our parents wouldn't act the way that they do. And so we take control by trying to change ourselves, and they let us. They let us think it's us. It's a travesty because children don't know any different, and they need their parents so bad and so deeply that they will believe that for life.
The big question is, do they, toxic people, ever change? And you also liken toxic family members to a billboard presenting an outward shiny, sleek image. And that's the only thing that really concerns them. So talk a little bit more about that.
They don't change because they don't see anything wrong with them. Even though they know somewhere inside of them that what they're doing isn't nice to other people, they don't think in terms of other people. They only think in terms of if they are getting their needs met or not. They only think in terms of if they like the way you handled something or not. That's why they tend to focus on our reaction but minimize their part in creating it. So human beings to them are things that they have to beat and or control. They don't view other people with hearts or sensitivities, and they expect other people to forgive them at all costs, yet they have no desire to offer those same rules back. In other words, they're less than model parents, but they expect perfect children. And so they don't change. They view themselves as above reproach. And because what they do works for them, they see no need to change a working formula because they don't really care how they make other people feel. They only care how other people make them feel. All they care about is what they look like to other people. And they only care about how other people respond to them. And this is in book two a little bit. There's got to be something quantum physics-wise related to DNA and emotional attachment. Because when it's your family and it's your tribe, those are your first gods, by the way, is your mother and father. And so when they hate you and you start off life that way, you enter every relationship feeling like you're fatally flawed. And it makes it really hard to convince yourself otherwise. If your own mother can't love you, how could anybody else? So no wonder this person treats me this way. And you justify abuse. And there's always reminders of family. When you see normal families that are helpful and loving toward each other, and you can't relate because you've never had that, your mom or dad terrorizes you, and you see that normal, healthy thing, and you instantly feel awkward, left out, and like you missed something really important, and it feels very unfair.
And you talk about in the book going no contact with toxic people. What are the important questions to ask before going no contact?
Is this person ever wrong? Do they apologize and change? Are you on repeat with abusive behavior over and over and over again? Are you always feeling hurt, always feeling confused and anxious? Do you dread hearing from that person?
So how do people move on and leave this toxic person / relationship in the past? And what methods and practices are successful? And I realize that might be different for each person.
I would say that therapy is definitely great. Reading is a great way to constantly remind yourself, because as their children, we will always want them to be different. My illusion was that if I went no contact, my abuse would stop. And I went no contact, but that doesn't mean that they changed. Their abuses are fewer, but they're harsher. And I still have to remain no contact. I don't give them the two things that they are craving, which is my attention and emotional reaction. For them, manipulating me is a sport, and I just have to continue to accept that and continue to read books that remind me of why I left. Because when those reminders stop, it's very easy for me to doubt myself.
Tell us about part two of the book.
So part two is going to come out, my hope is 2021 in April. And it's writing about my experiences of untangling the self-doubt and dealing with people who cannot grasp that I've had to do this, and opinions given to me when they have not been asked for or solicited, and quick judgments made without ever having my experience. I have faced a lot in the aftermath of cutting ties that I didn't know I would face, nor did I want to face. And I felt it would be important to share how our self-doubts were developed through our childhood developmental process and how we handle flying monkeys, which are the people our toxic people enlist after we cut ties to break our boundaries for them, what to do with wills and trusts, and what you need to walk away from. All of that good stuff is in there.
Those are great points, especially the wills and trust.
Money is their God, all toxic people, because it allows them to play God. Just teaching people don't send gifts back. It gives them a reaction, you know, a lot of coping skills on how to stay no contact, because you have to maintain your safety. It doesn't end because you go no contact. In fact, it incenses them and it makes them want to get under your skin in many ways even more.
The name of the book is But It's Your Family.
Cutting Ties with Toxic Family and Loving Yourself in the Aftermath. And I want to mention that before But It's Your Family Part 2 comes out, I'm releasing a new book I just signed a contract for that's called Your Pocket Therapist. It's like healing moments all the way through the book. So it's quick hacks to deal with toxic people and empower yourself. That's coming out hopefully in October.
Great. And is that through Morgan James Publishing as well?
Yeah. I wanted to follow up, But It's Your Family, with those quick hacks, because all my patients are like, God, I wish I could just put you in my pocket, you know, and have that so I don't react and fall prey to them.
Final thoughts or comments, Dr. Sherry?
Just for the listeners, just know you're worthy of it. Love yourself. You know, if your family members can't love you, that isn't a problem with you. It's a problem with them. And I want to leave you on that note.
Thank you, Dr. Sherry, for your time and speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our next segment is the final installment of Broadband, our show within a show. Denise Kowalczyk is the creator of Broadband and the creator of The Politics of Living. She is currently producing a podcast entitled Arclectic New England and Exploring Other Opportunities. We wish her the very best in all her future endeavors. Here's Broadband.
Hello and welcome to Broadband, a segment that is part feature soul and part food for thought. It features personal reflection and information about some great things going on in the community, because you need to take care of yourself before you can take care of the world, right? On today's segment, Nancy Alda returns with Bringing Myth to Life. This month, she reflects on dreaming. I also have a song by Rhode Island band Belly, but first, I interviewed Della Ray about her new project, the Oregon Women's Health Network. Della Ray is an entrepreneur based in the Portland area, and she is bringing women's health to a whole new level. Della Ray, welcome to Broadband.
Thank you so much, Denise.
I know a lot about you. We've known each other for quite a few years now, but some of the listeners might not know who Della Ray is. Who are you in the world?
First, thank you for having me. Denise, I have just so much appreciation for you and what you're doing in the world. So back at you. You know, that's always a question when people say, who are you? I always start off with what's important to me as a person, which is advocating for women. Because I personally believe, you know, through all the talks and everything that's happening in the world, the way forward is women's overall health. So I'm a community advocate of women having access to the information and connection to one another to advance women's overall health.
So you launched Oregon Women's Health Network. How long has it been around, and why did you create it?
Well, actually, I didn't create Oregon Women's Health Network. It's been around since 1994.
Oh.
And it began as an initiative from the county, Multnomah County. And it started to bring women together around topics, maternal health, sexual health, all these different topics for women working within the Multnomah County. And I served on the committee several years ago. It moved hands from the county to OHSU, and just really the attention necessary for to continue Oregon Women's Health Network, the resources weren't available. As being an advocate, an author, and really seeing the importance of this moving forward, I acquired Oregon Women's Health Network last year.
Gotcha. Thank you for clarifying. Let's talk a little bit about women's health in the context of this organization's work. Is its focus only on physical well-being?
Thank you for asking that. It's actually not focused on necessarily physical. It's really focused on the inside out. It's focused on breaking down conversations around isms and mental health and self-advocacy. And there's business and finance and environment included in that. But our first year, Denise, we've really been focusing on the isms conversations. And what we have found to be so interesting is that so many women have been looking for a space to have these very important conversations.
So how does that look exactly? Are you hosting happy hours? Are you hosting classroom settings? I mean, how do you have these conversations and facilitate them?
So what we do is they've been monthly. And we have this amazing space in Portland that is, and let me back up and say something that's super important. One of the reasons why and what OWEN, Oregon Women's Health Network, is based in is making sure that we provide inclusive and accessible events. So they're located in a space where there's parking, our tickets are affordable, because we don't want any of those things to be a barrier for women to be able to come together. So that's really, really important. And this is how we measure what we are doing as an organization and as an agency with each meeting. So given that, we bring women together monthly, we have food and we do have wine, and we as a committee sit and pick subjects. And then we have panelists. Typically, I facilitate the discussion. We have panelists. We go for each panelist gets the opportunity to speak, and then we open up to the audience to be able to give feedback, ask questions. And we have yet to experience an event where at the end, women are ready to go home. They want to stay, they want to talk, they want to engage. And so it's been a really incredible experience.
That is definitely a sign when people are, I'm not ready to go, and that you've touched on something that is important to them. So kudos to you. Are you familiar with the book by Rumer Godden called Everyone is a House with Four Rooms? Are you familiar with that? I have not quite read it yet, but I bring it up because it's related to this conversation. So in the book, it's a memoir, I believe, and she talks about everyone has a house, and we have four rooms, a spiritual, mental, physical, and emotional. She believes you have to go into each one of those rooms every day
to have a full, balanced life. I mean, how do you feel or think how these areas all kind of intersect with one another in your work at Oregon Women's Health Network? Is there some synergy there and all that?
There is, but you know what, Denise, what I believe, and I've believed this for a long time, and when I do presentations and facilitate discussions, it's from the lens for me personally is that it starts from with how we think and feel about ourselves. And the reason why I feel so strongly about that, because you start talking about the physical and these other pieces, if we don't know how we think and feel about ourselves, really getting the physical and the spiritual pieces accurate or even close to who we really are, I don't think it's possible without really focusing on what we think and feel about ourselves.
That's a really good point. I'm pausing to process that. It's the core starting point, right, of who we are inside helps inform or support you in who we are on the outside, out in the world. That's very true. And this is such a big question, but bear with me. What are like the top three things that you come to mind that you could suggest to women look for as far as positive health? So would one be self-reflection? Like three things.
So I have three things I believe in basic self-care. And there are three rules. And the first one is be okay with you. And I say that not through the okey-doke or through rose-colored glasses, but it's about knowing what our story is and being okay with what our strengths are and our weaknesses. That's number one. Number two is to never mind the good opinion of other people. We spend so much time worrying and thinking about what other people think, and it does not help us. And don't get me wrong, we all want to be liked and accepted, but when we allow other people's judgment to replace our own, we get into trouble every time. And when we look to other people for approval instead of having that within ourselves, we compromise ourselves every time. And then the third thing I really think is important is letting go of yesterday. It's great and groovy. We make mistakes. And how life works is we keep getting those lessons until we learn them. So letting go of yesterday is really critical. And letting go of the idea of, if I would have done this, if I could have done this, if I should have done this, you know, that saying, do not should on yourself. That's so important. And we have no way, real way of knowing if we would have done something different, the outcome would have been different. So letting go of yesterday is paramount. And so, again, if you'll notice, all three of those pieces are from the inside out.
You know, you are hitting the nails on the head, my friend. And I have a question that I try to insert in every interview I do. And I think this is the point to ask you this question. The F word, failure. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are your thoughts around how you navigate failure? And how you actually, if you do, which I think you do, welcome it as a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, Denise, I'm an entrepreneur, right? In 1 6-year period, I started 2 nonprofit organizations and 1 for-profit organization. I've written 3 books. I've done presentations, and here I am now the director and sole proprietor of the Oregon Women's Health Network. Failure is so important because it helps you to realize when things are moving smoothly. It helps you to humble yourself and to be able to face things that may not necessarily be going the way that you would like them to go. I welcome failure because then when it helps me to learn about myself and helps me to learn about what's around me and to appreciate those things that are going really well.
I love that, actually. I really love that. And I agree with failure. You know, as a society or culture, we don't live in a world that even acknowledges it, let alone celebrating what you can learn from the experience of not hitting the nail on the head. Personally, I've been really opening that up and being more of a risk taker, because you have to be a risk taker in order to get to your goals and explore. And learning when you stumble, you know, and it's okay. It's not a waste of time. It's part of the process.
Sure. But you know what? I invite you to think about something, though. You mentioned that we're, as a society, we're not trained to think about failures, but I push back. And this is one of the reasons why I do this work with women, because women are quick to point out their failures. I don't think that that's true, that we're taught to avoid failures, mm-hmm. because I think that women as a whole are quick to point out their own failures and let those lead them instead of putting them where they belong. With the meeting that we just had a month ago, I was listening to women use words about themselves that were not positive, and not saying that you have to be positive, but just they would, I'm this, I'm that. I think that one of the things I hope to influence in the world is how women do think about themselves and their quote unquote failures.
So that's a great segue to my next question. How can women encourage each other to pursue better health?
Well, you know, I'm talking about that internal health, right? I think women do that by setting the example and having conversation that is rooted in what they're doing for themselves. Because women are taught, if we talk about ourselves, we're selfish. If we put time into ourselves, we're selfish. So we do this by first doing it, right? We cannot give that which we do not have. So if we're trying to go help other people do things that we're not doing, it's not going to work eventually.
Well, I have just one final question for you. What is your vision for the Oregon Women's Health Network? What kind of change in the world? You've touched on a little bit, but when you look down the path, what would you like to see as far as the impact your organization has on women?
Well, what I will say is, Denise, based on the events that we have had, and we are in the city of Portland, and we are seeing at our events diversity in every sense of the word like you have never seen in Portland. We are talking age, race, abilities. These women are showing up in all forms at our meetings, at our events. When you walk into an OWN event, I want that to be the scene every time, first of all. Second of all, at the end of each meeting, the emails and the feedback, women saying, wow, I learned something I didn't know. I was in a space where I felt safe and where I could listen and I could feel heard. While that may not sound as big and as grand as other organizations, that's really important to me. And I'm not seeking to change anyone. I'm seeking to provide a space where women can just learn and have provocative conversation. Because I do not believe change can come without getting down to the root of why it is the way it is to begin with. And that would be a full stop for me.
To learn more about this education and training network advancing women's overall health, visit OregonWomensHealthNetwork.com. Each month, Nancy Alder shares a reflection on a topic. And on this month's Bringing Myth to Life, she offers this perspective on dreaming.
When we talk about pursuing our dreams, it's usually about a degree, career, relationship, home, or adventure that we want to feel more secure or more alive. Unfortunately, most of these dreams are part of the myth of our consumer culture and can imprison us with a sense of failure if we fall short, or a sense of discontent even if we succeed. For how often does life work out as we planned? Instead of pursuing your dreams, I invite you to let your dreams pursue you. Notice the images that recur in your sleeping dreams, daytime synchronicities, stories, art, walks in nature, and when you're doing what lights you up. These are intimate, encrypted messages from a part of you that longs for a deeper experience of being human and to contribute something uniquely valuable. But how do you figure out what they mean? While reclaiming my life after leaving my marriage, an image came through my writing of walking through a dark wood, carrying something warm and glowing in my cupped hands. It later appeared in a series of dreams as a gleeful gesture of offering to a street crowded with people. I was eager to understand, so I started meditating on this image, collaging and sculpting it, and bringing the gesture into my dance. I gradually realized that I am protecting something secret and precious from outside forces that threaten to extinguish it, and seeking a hearth where it can offer others warmth, nourishment, and a safe place for storytelling. I can look at my life and feel like a failure because I've abandoned so many of my dreams, but this image shows me I'm not a teacher, coach, manager, or wife. I'm an ember tender. I don't have to have a formal role or be on fire with creative energy. I just have to share warmth and nourishing truths in these times of darkness. So watch for the dreams that come to you. Invite them closer with your imagination. And as they reveal your secrets, find ways to live them more fully each day and discover a sense of purpose, belonging, and contentment that endures as all other things fade away.
Bringing Myth to Life was presented by Nancy Otter. You can learn more about her work of exploring mystical, spiritual traditions and psychology with a focus on shamanic practice, shadow work, and applied mythology by visiting her website, innerwoven.net. Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Broadband. Thanks to my guest, Ella Ray of the Oregon Women's Health Network, for joining me, and Nancy Otter for her contribution to the show. And thanks for listening. I'm going to close out with a bit of music by a band called Belly. The band formed in Rhode Island in 1991 by former Throwing Muses and Breeders member Tanya Donnelly, where she and the other members attended high school. Here's their song, Girl, from their album, Dove. Have a great day, and thanks for listening.
singing, the birds of the air singing.
The She-Ra Solution is a monthly biography of women, past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Its title is inspired by Maria Teresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published June 16, 2016 in The Atlantic. This month, it's the tale of bras and girdles, spacesuits, and history-making moonwalks, and the women who sewed the bridge that linked them. Here's Kristen Thiel.
When NASA astronauts are in space, it's said they spend their time in two spacecrafts, the shuttle and their spacesuits. Their suits allow them to travel just as the shuttle does, protecting them equally as well from extreme temperatures, extreme light, and flying debris. Anything that important probably has a story behind it, and spacesuits are no exception. What is interesting is what a tangled history they have with women. They've thwarted us and been made by us, and spacesuits have also been inspired by women's earthly clothing choices. Earlier this year, two women were scheduled to do a spacewalk, but one was prevented from going because, in the 11th hour, NASA didn't have the right size suit prepared. Looming darkly in the way of history being made, one small but mighty piece of fabric. But long before this frustrating setback, a bra manufacturer, yes, really, designed and crafted the first iteration of the modern spacesuit. Without women, we wouldn't have had the suit we have today. Because of short-sightedness, suits today are not well-suited for women. Okay, so, what happened back in the 1960s? Well, NASA was ready to take its space program to the next level, and this necessitated a whole new spacesuit design. Previous ones were stiff and clunky, like a cartoon version of a spacesuit. It was Playtex, the makers of bras and girdles, who stepped forward with the out-of-the-box thinking that true revolution required. Their 1967 all-fabric design was both flexible and durable, and they were willing to put some of their expert seamstresses on the job. This was key because these suits were fussy. Each one was 21 layers of wispy thin fabric, sewn to a precise tolerance of 1/64 of an inch. Playtex didn't tell their seamstresses what their new assignment was. They just sent them over to the new workroom. Anna Lee Minner told CBS News she was stunned when she went from sewing, quote, little pieces like this to big pieces like this. The new work quickly took a toll on the women. Minner said, quote, I went home on many a night and cried because I knew I couldn't do it. I was scared. This was a person's life this depended on. And also, if they left something like a stray pin in the suit, their boss stuck them with it as a pointed reminder of the seriousness of the task. There was big pressure, but also big rewards. Joanna Thompson told CBS, quote, we would have astronauts come in and thank us, and that was a real boost. It made a connection there that you didn't forget. On July 20th, 1969, the women watched Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin step onto the moon in the spacesuits they had sewn. And for them, Lily Elliott said, quote, that was a pinnacle of watching something that you've helped do. With each step the astronauts took, Elliott wondered, quote, oh my, I wonder if that's going to hold. Oh my, I wonder if this is going to be all right. I hope that stitch didn't pop. Today, Playtex's parent company is still making spacesuits. And women continue to be the less famous, but incredibly crucial visionaries and crafters behind both these mini spacecrafts and the regular size ones. For example, today, Lian Fem considers herself a, quote, spacecraft dressmaker. For almost 20 years, she's been making thermal blankets that wrap around spacecrafts to regulate their temperature. And her background is also in, guess what, lingerie. Her family left Vietnam in 1978, persecuted for their religion and their politics. Her first job after they settled in Los Angeles was making lingerie for the brand Olga. To make more money, she eventually moved on and trained in electronics assembly. The blend of fabric and cable manipulation on her resume set her up perfectly for work on materials used by the space program. It's poignant that the bra, a sometimes annoying trapping of society, a female tax so many of us pay whether or not we want to, helped women ensure the success of the U.S. space program. If only the people in top leadership positions would order suits in our sizes, so we could be revolutionaries even more up among the stars. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was Kristen Thiel with the She-Ra Solution. In this month's edition of Let's Stop for a Minute, ML Laurie explores why we hide our concerns and fears and why the mask of aggression is so valued in America. Here's Let's Stop for a Minute with ML Laurie.
So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about this. In my last segment, we talked about the shared belief that most people have that we are alone in our human condition and how this affects our self-esteem and happiness. We talked about how we don't share our fears and concerns with others because we're afraid of being vulnerable and maybe hurt in some way. We then came back again to how this comes from looking to others, something outside of ourselves, for happiness, and a learned faulty software program that we are what other people say or think we are. We discussed the reality that if we were what others say or think we are, then everyone would see us the same way. We know there's no reality in this thinking. Different people see us and others differently, and this is because of their learned software programs. So we ended with the thinking that we are all human beings and share many of the same fears and concerns. And I left you with the questions. Do you believe that everyone feels insecure? And do you believe that understanding the secrets of our human experience or condition can increase our self-esteem and thereby our happiness? So these questions came from the conversation in the last segment about how we all share certain fears and concerns, but tend to believe we are alone in these concerns and fears, which is actually just part of our shared human experience. Because we don't share our concerns with others, but keep them to ourselves like secrets, I've come to call them secrets. The idea is to share these secrets so we don't feel alone in them and can thereby increase our self-esteem with the really cool side effect of increasing our happiness. So, how do we feel when we're feeling insecure? Let's stop for a minute and think about this. What is this feeling of feeling insecure? If you ask people to describe what they're feeling when they feel insecure, many people would use words like anxious or scared or nervous, or sometimes people feel anger. But if you stop for a minute when you're feeling this insecurity and think about it and become in touch with what's going on with you, you often will discover that what is really behind this feeling of insecurity is fear. So once again, we are back to worrying about what others think about us, to believing that what others think about us is true. Again, if what others thought about us was true, then everybody would think the same thing. You know, it's simple. Many famous people, some people like them, some people don't like them. If they were what each of us thought they were, we would see the exact same thing. But we don't, and that's because we have different minds, and we think differently, and we judge things differently, and we perceive things differently. So this insecurity is back to worrying about what others think about us. It is actually fear. So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about this. How do we feel when we look around at others and think we are the only ones that feel insecure? It's a rare person who's never done this, and certainly a rare person who's never felt insecure. Although with the things that I'm trying to talk to you about, another part of the reason for the conversation is to increase your inner sense of self and strengthen your self-esteem, and this will make you more secure, and thereby you won't feel this insecurity when you run into people and things because you won't be looking to them for your happiness. So why do you think that others don't appear insecure when we see them? Even if they are and are keeping it to themselves, how is it that we aren't able to see their insecurity? Well, mainly this is because people wear masks. People present themselves to others as they want others to see them or think about them. Partially, this is because of what we discussed in our last segment, that we think we are what others say or think we are, and are often trying to compensate for any negative view someone might possibly have of us. The other part is simply out of fear of being hurt in some way. Maybe someone might make fun of us or put us down if we showed our vulnerability. So we wear masks. So what kind of mask are we talking about? Well, there are as many masks as there are people, but there are a few common ones that we can see. We have talked before about how many people actually admire an aggressive person who doesn't take any stuff. This is the mask of aggression, which is often seen as strong, but in reality is based in fear. This is more prominent in America than in some other cultures. Not all cultures actually admire aggression. Some cultures actually see aggression as a sign of immaturity. But the behavior of wearing a mask is a common universal tendency. So let's stop for a minute and think about this. How is it that the aggressive mask is such a common mask in America, particularly in the most recent years? Do we see the bully as strong? After all, he doesn't take any stuff. Some people see Donald Trump as a bully, and other people see him just as someone who doesn't take any stuff and admire him. So who is correct? I saw an interview with Anderson Cooper and Mr. Shock Jock Howard Stern. And in this, Howard Stern talked about for the first time in his life, he had started to have therapy. And now having dealt with his issues from his childhood, he is a much, much happier person and he wished he had done it earlier. And he talked about how not dealing with these issues were what made him the shock jock and to do all the over-the-top things. Yes, it made him a lot of fame, but he was very clear in saying that these were all ways of sort of acting out the difficulties he was having from the software programs that he had learned in his life. He also then began to talk about Donald Trump, who he says he knows very well. And he was recommending and hoping that Donald Trump would have therapy because he began to talk about Donald Trump's childhood and his father, who was, I guess, on some level abusive in like he was stern. And Donald Trump will tell you that he learned from his father not to apologize, always focus on winning. So this is why you get some of the things that you do with him. But probably the most obvious thing that shows Donald Trump's low self-esteem is his attack on anyone who, even in the slightest way, he interprets as saying anything negative about him. So he immediately has to come to his self-defense. And if you feel secure, you don't need to do that. Let's take the most secure people in the world, maybe His Holiness the Dalai Lama of Tibet, the Pope. Neither of these people, yeah, they're holy beings, but that doesn't make a difference. We're talking about security as a person. And these two holy beings would never strike out at another person. The Dalai Lama says that Mao Zedong was his greatest teacher because he taught him patience. Mao Zedong is the Chinese leader who invaded and took over Tibet, which is still under Chinese control. So that's quite amazing that you can do this. And in my life, I've been privileged to meet some of these high lamas that come out of Chinese prisons. And it's quite amazing to see these holy people who actually have compassion for the Chinese, even though they tortured them. So this is security. I've told adolescents as I've worked with them that it is not the bully or maybe the popular girls or whoever it is that's making fun of others that are the secure people. Security comes with a show of kindness. The 16th century saint, St. Francis de Sales, said, "Nothing is so strong as gentleness and nothing is so gentle as real strength." Someone who is secure usually has some level of compassion and kindness and patience with others. It's the impatient, angry person who actually is, from a professional point of view, an obviously very insecure individual. So anger and aggression is just another way of showing fear. It's the fight or flight. So you're fearful, you can stand up and fight, or you can fly away and maybe hover in the corner and get depressed or however that would manifest. But the whole idea is that you can be Donald Trump, who is one of the most famous people in the world, has lots of money, has a beautiful wife, a good family, and has everything that we all would think we would externally need in order to be a happy person, and he is not a happy person. If you observe him, you rarely see him smile. And it seems like the only time he seems to smile is when he is attacking someone else, which is quite interesting because maybe that smile comes from the whole idea of, okay, I am secure now because I attacked that person. I've come back and now I can feel secure. And that's quite an interesting concept when you think about it, how you can smile when you feel secure. So we all feel insecure at times. It's part of the human condition. It all correlates with our level of self-esteem. The higher your self-esteem, the more secure you feel, and the more happy you are. It just goes hand in hand. And it's hard to have a high self-esteem when you come from the faulty software program that all of who you are and what you are and your happiness is dependent upon things outside of yourself, no matter what that is. So let's stop for a minute and think about this. Do you think everyone wears a mask? Do you think that people are aware that they wear a mask? Do you think that our happiness is related to the mask that we wear? So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about it. Let's think about all of this. I'm ML Laurie.
Well, that concludes this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests and our contributors, Sherry Campbell, Nancy Alder, Della Ray, ML Laurie, Kristen Thiel, and Denise Kowalczyk. Also, a final thanks to our web manager and creator, Denise Kowalczyk. Visit kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living, Episode 30, to find links about today's topics and guests. If you'd like to be a guest or a contributor on The Politics of Living, or if you have feedback, comments, or suggestions, please email us at tpol@kboo.org. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, just go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Vicki Mazzone.